Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the glow of St. Paul's number one, welcome to another edition of Cabin Country. Give us the time and we'll take you out of the traffic and away from the levee. Let's find the place where the loons call out among the moonlit waves, where the wind sighs among the Norway pines. Pull up a dock chair, have a sip of your coffee, and get a line in the water. This is Cabin Country. Now here's Bjorn Lloydsted, and I'm Fudd Klugman, with another Woodland Escape.
All right, I'd like to welcome you back to Cabin Country. We've been on hiatus for a bit with the winter setting in. Fudd, it's been a cold, cold couple of months here.
It has. It has. It's been a while, and it's been the same old. Lots of snow, lots of cold. But a lot of things to look forward to, though.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, as the days get longer and the sun keeps shining, the snow starts slowly melting away. Our thoughts, of course, immediately go to the Tracker.
Oh, yeah.
The open water of the Gull River and whatever lakes and bays may be calling. But we're still kind of in the heart of it right now. It's we got a good snowfall last week and short one last night, and I thought, shoot, do I want to shovel snow tonight or at 5:30 in the morning before I take the car back to work?
Yes, yeah. I looked out and I thought, well, I thought we were supposed to get a dusting, not enough to shovel, but
yeah, oh yeah. I was even asked by my wife, are you going to take out the snowblower tonight? And I said, no, there's are you snowblower? You've got to be kidding me! And about half an hour into the shoveling of what appeared to be 3 inches of snow, I was thought, well, you know, this would have gone a lot faster had I fired up the snowblower.
Right.
But that said, with cold nipping at hands, nose, and ears, all I can think is, oh my gosh, at some point this is all going to be gone, and we'll be testing the weight of the line on the reels. I'll be getting a new fishing license. We'll be northward bound.
That's right, and we were just talking a moment ago, Bjorn and I, about how the Tracker's going to live up at the cabin during the summer. And,
right.
And we're going to invest in a lift. You know, I think part of helping us to decide to buy the boat, my wife and I thought, well, you know, we'll take it up each time we go, but we'll leave it at home because, hey, we've got plenty of lakes nearby. We can get some friends together.
Land of 10,000 lakes. Here we go.
Hang out and do a little fishing. But no, I've decided that when I do my fishing and when I'm on the water, it's up in cabin country. I mean, all of Minnesota is basically cabin country, but in the Brainerd area, and we're on the Gull River specifically, so looking forward this year to not having a new adventure each time I go to put the boat in with my van.
It's time you got with it.
Whether or not I'm going to take it out and rely on the kindness of others to help pull it out. But so looking forward to that, the nice warm water and early spring, and we're gonna
sunshine and the oak leaves, the maple leaves, the aspen leaves.
We're gonna get you a new frog jitterbug, I think, this year.
Oh man,
because you had so much luck.
I did. It was a great season last summer and early fall. Never really caught a bass in my life, and within 10 minutes, I suddenly had two on, and one that, I don't know if you remember, Fudd, but he broke the line.
Oh, yeah.
and then broke the water. He was up thrashing around out of the water with my vintage Arbogast.
Yes. You know,
jitterbug frog pattern hanging out of the corner of his mouth trying to break that thing free, and a better sized bass than the one
we ended up keeping.
That you later ate.
I did. It was delicious.
I had a bite of it myself. It was good. It was very good. I will say I'm a new man. I'm a changed man. I would eat bass in future.
And, excellent.
And that for me is a rarity because there's ocean fish. Amen. I'm all over it. You've heard this before. But for some reason for me, the freshwater fish have often tasted fishy. I can't quite put my, you know.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't like bass. Even our friend Mike Leon doesn't care for eating bass. He prefers the northern. And some, you know, the bigger ones, if you keep them, they can be a little weedy tasting.
Sure.
They smell like the lake they came from.
River grass.
But that one you caught that was pretty young.
Yeah.
Probably a couple of years old. I don't know. And it was delicious. And there's something about eating the fish that you catch yourself.
Right.
It's even better.
Right.
So, cooked over an open fire in an iron skillet.
Indeed.
This is the way we did it, and it was delish.
That was a tough fishing trip, though. I not only lost the vintage Rebel.
Oh, yeah.
But I lost the Arbogast Jitterbug Frog. It was a tough
yeah,
go.
Yeah, a couple of losses.
Or three big rubberized white whales you tossed out, too.
Yeah.
Quickly ingested by,
we're
guessing, a large northern pike, because you said it hit like a concrete block and was suddenly gone.
Wait a minute, I think, boing, it's gone.
Yeah. This is going to be good. And it's gone. So, but the ospreys were trailing us and circling and enjoying, hey, maybe these guys will catch something they don't want. They seem to be onto something. We're going to follow them around. I think we had four osprey flying over us.
And yeah.
Doing a circle pattern, fighting a little bit, and occasionally diving. It was a good day out. Very good day out. But all things fishing, and that said, and realizing we're not getting outside anytime soon.
Not for a while.
This takes me back to a trip I made with Captain Dave Stricker, who is now on the board. I hope I haven't just blown his cover or upset anyone at the Minnesota Commercial Fishing Museum, but he's a proud member of the Minnesota Commercial Fishing Museum, which is a museum, not surprisingly, dedicated to the pioneers who came over and the locals who'd been here the whole time, who made a living fishing Gitche-Gumee, the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Often going out by themselves or in pairs in an 18-foot fishing skiff with one or two old, you know, well, our guest tonight would refer to them as Janssens.
Yeah.
Janssens.
A pair of 14-horse Janssens with the the cord. You wrap the cord and pull it. A couple of old outboards on the back and the kind of gas where you're mixing the oil right into the tank and going out and freezing.
Right.
You know, in the spring, freezing in the fall, setting these deep nets with the lead weights or the glass weights on the bottom and spending your time out on Lake Superior early morning. And hoping you've hauled in quite a netful or several, filling up that skiff to riding very low in the water, bringing it back, and then getting back to work, you know, going to the fish house, cleaning these things out, salting them, putting them in barrels, packing them up, you know, labeling the barrels, and then bringing them to market. And where am I going with all this? Well, we have some digitized interviews with an old Tofty area, Hovland area fisherman. I was going to say farmer. Not at all, sir. Fisherman. He was a Norwegian immigrant to the United States and specifically Minnesota. His name was Helmer Akvik, and he had a very interesting story to tell.
Oh, yes.
He was both fisherman and at one point an attempted rescuer of a neighbor who was also a fisherman, who went out one evening to check the nets even though he'd been warned against when the gales of November come slashing. He was going out to check the nets and was warned not to do it, but went out anyway, and Helmer's comment was, well, I'm a man of my word. I'm going out, and I'm coming back.
Uh-huh.
And that will be interesting. So we have tonight for you, this afternoon, this morning, whenever you're listening to it, kind of a piece of vintage cabin country from Helmer Akvik of Hovland, Minnesota, kind of near the Tofty area. He was a lifer, and he's got some interesting stories about, A, the days of commercial fishing on Lake Superior, what they would catch, what what they would fill their nets with and what's no longer there anymore, mm-hmm. what's disappeared over the time, you know, the decades having passed. Is it, you know, he'll kind of pine about, is it cycles of fish? Do they just live certain times and then they kind of disappear and then they come back? Or is it, in fact, even back when he was interviewed, I think in the late 70s or early 80s, you know, this is a fairly old interview. He too will say, even back in the day, maybe it's the pollution.
Mm.
You know, maybe the footprint we've placed on our lakes is doing some damage to the local stocks and things that used to be catchable that are no longer around. And so we've got some interesting material here. Helmer, I will tell you, sounds an awful lot, Fudd, like several of my now sadly deceased relatives from outstate greater Minnesota. Heavy Norwegian brogue.
Yeah.
And I'll warn you listeners at this point, and Fudd, you can join in on this, Helmer's brogue can be so thick at times.
Oof,
it's very hard to understand.
We'll have to try to interpret.
We'll try to interpret Helmer. We speak Okvik, and we'll try to cut through it for you a little bit. But all in all, it's a pretty interesting interview if you've ever thought about what would it be like to be fishing solo at 5 o'clock in the morning on Lake Superior, you know, 3 miles out from shore in 36-degree water, you know?
Wow.
Oil skins and wool mitts on your hands and all these kinds of things. And the big rubber boots and hoping the weather keeps kind, I guess we could say. What cracks me up right out of the gate here, Fudd, is he's talking about being on he calls it a wind yammer.
Wind yammer.
It's a wind yammer. And some of the interviewee, he's the interviewee, excuse me, but the interviewer is saying, a what? You know, wind yammer. And then he makes a joke. Oh, you mean the Christian Radic? You know, which was this big Norwegian tall ship. They love to bring the tall ships into Duluth Harbor every now and again. Have these huge kind of conventions of 3 to 4 masted sailing ships, and they all come together at certain times of the year and certain years of the decade. You know, it's not an annual event. But boy, I remember all my Norwegian farmer relatives talking about how cool. Might go to Duluth to see the Christian Radic. I sat in so many farm living rooms, you know, watching my folks drink coffee. Oh, the Christian Radic's going to be here. Oh, I got to go see the Christian Radic. And Helmer talks about it, too, with, I felt just a hint of disdain.
Oh,
but
yeah?
Who knows? Who knows? It could be interesting. Maybe without further ado, welcome back to Cabin Country. We're glad to join you again, and perhaps you'll enjoy hearing these tales of yesteryear from Norwegian-American immigrant, fisherman, and rescuer would be Helmer Okvik.
Well, yeah, we'll put it up.
So now
and we'll just talk for a few minutes.
Where's the microphone?
It's right in here. I didn't bring the other microphone.
Oh, here, right here, yeah.
Yeah, so I just put that in here.
Well,
maybe grab me start with the beginning.
Yeah.
You see, I'm a foreign born. I'm a Norwegian. So I sailed for 3 years on the windjammer.
On the what?
Windjammer.
You see them only on calendars now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is that the one they brought into Duluth?
It was not big as that, no, but that was a schooner.
Mm-hmm.
No, that was not as big as that.
No.
You mean this is Christian Radic?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. She lost her sail on the way back.
That's what I heard, yeah.
And they tried to collect money, but the Norwegians, they are richer than anyone now. I don't see why they should donate $60,000 for sail.
Yeah, right.
No. Okay. Well, then I came to this country and I roomed around in the southwestern part of the state. Quite a few years, you see. I was a hired man on the farms, even. That is where I met Christine.
Is it Christine, your wife's name? Huh. Your wife's name is Christine?
Yeah,
Christine.
Yeah. And then in 1924, I took a notion to... Yeah, I roomed around there. I worked on a farm 3 or 4 years, you see. Then I started painting barns and churches.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a,
what year would that be?
Oh, that would be in 20, 21, 2, 3.
Oh, yeah.
You see, in 24, I took a notion to go out to the West Coast. That was in 1924. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got on a halibut schooner there. That was a rough life.
A halibut schooner.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long did you do that?
Oh, I was a season dead. I was a whole season dead. I had no sleep.
No.
A lot of fog, you know, out in the Pacific. We went 3 weeks out, well, the trip was 3 weeks. Went out to a bank they called Tillamook Bank. It was the halibut bank.
Tillamook?
Tillamook Bank, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Not Tillamook, Tillamook. M-O-O-K.
Oh, Tillamook, M-O-O-K.
Yeah, Tillamook, yeah. And I was a rough life, all right.
Well, you must have been in your 20s then, huh?
Yeah, more than that, I guess. 23, 4, 22.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other day we had ice in the hole there, and it was 3-4 weeks out, you see. No refrigeration, refrigerator on the ship. Was ice in the hull. And the ice to halibut, you see.
Oh, yeah.
Then
right.
We went into port. And there was once we couldn't cross the Columbia bar. Remember that plainly. You see, the bar there, it breaks, you know, when them big swells come in from the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was up. We had to tie ourselves in the bunks. We thrown out, you know, and we were trying to get a little sleep. Yeah. Yeah.
How'd you like to do that, Billy?
And the worst, you see, we had two Norwegians. There was a crew of 6-7 men on the schooner, mm-hmm. You know. It was a big ship, in other words. Between 90 and 100 feet. Captain's name was Janssen. And these two Norwegians, they were so seasick that it was pitiful. Out in the ocean there, I had orders from the captain to carry him out on deck to get an orange into him and get a little sunshine on him. We thought they were going to die. I never seen anything like that.
I didn't think Norwegians could get seasick.
Oh, and they won one arm. He swore out that if he ever set to reach shore and set his foot on the dock in Astoria, never again were we going to see him. See him on a boat around the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I never seen him around the boats anymore, so he must have kept his word.
Maybe he got to be a farmer, huh?
I don't know what became of him. I came back here, you know, in 25. And then I had a friend that used to fish togs here out of the Lute when the bottom herring was plentiful.
He fished what?
Herring, yeah. He induced me to come up here, you see, on the shore.
Mm-hmm.
And we stationed at Cascade or Eagle Bay, rather, at a place there. And then I got a notion I was coming down here to Hovland. In 27, I moved there to Hovland.
Mm-hmm.
Lived in a log house there in the bay. It was torn down not long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we fished here for... And Depression set in, you know.
Right.
The Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
29-30. I started to pick up. Fishing was good, you know, from 27 and 30. Then the war started, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The herring got the sky high, you know. Racing on meat.
Do you remember how much a pound of herring was back there in about 1930?
You couldn't sell them. 75 cents for the 100 pounds.
When you came to Hovland, did you live here? Is this the only place you've lived?
No, in Chicago Bay, right in the bay. I lived in a log house there for quite a while.
He built this in 1930, so that's all.
1931 or something. But during the war, that was a good time. You see, about 17 cents a pound for the herring. There was one night I made $150 on herring.
In 1940-something.
Well, I was after 40. Yeah, 40, the war was going on for a while. Yeah, I sat smiling.
Any trout fishing then?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Trout was good. We used to get 700 pounds. And he brought a big dispenser of fried chicken legs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we lived good.
Yeah.
I can't lie to you, Fudd. My Akvik at this point is a little rough. I swear he just said, I worked then at a dispensary with fried chicken Larson. Now, and I'm not trying to poke fun at Elmer here, but it is very much like talking to a couple of my great uncles.
Yes.
There were times where I would just sit there as they drank coffee and ate cookies, and I'm thinking, I am missing a I lot of... This is family history, I think. But what is it? You know? So he worked in a dispensary for Fried Chicken Larson. And at this point, the Cabin Country broadcast is putting out an all call. If anybody knows a Fried Chicken Larson or recalls... Or maybe I got it completely wrong.
Is this a person, place, or thing?
Exactly. And I don't know, Fudd. I thought it was interesting to hear him talk there briefly about Tillamook Bank.
Oh,
fishing
yes.
for halibut in the old vessels without refrigeration. They got to fill the hold with ice.
And
Tillamook is a town in Oregon right on the Pacific coast.
Okay.
And home of Tillamook High School, the Fighting Cheesemakers.
Oh.
And I'm not making this up.
Really?
I drove
in Oregon.
The whole town smells like cheddar cheesemaker. It's unbelievable. But it sounds like he had a crazy time fishing halibut. A couple of Norwegian sailors who were so seasick, he tried to get them up on deck and get them into the sun and some fresh air and see the horizon. I don't know if you've ever enjoyed seasickness or not, but if you're down in the hold under decks and people are getting seasick, that's like rule one. Get up on deck. See the horizon. That will hopefully help you counteract that seasick feeling. I like that story about the one guy swore if he got back to town, he'd get on the dock. He'd never put to sea again. And he didn't. He lived up to his words. So, have you heard anything thus far, Fudd, that kind of...
Well, what did he say? He earned 75 cents for 100 pounds?
100 pounds of herring.
Of herring. So he said he couldn't sell it. I mean, it was... He was
kind of giving it away, and then...
The demand wasn't...
The fishing was good during the Great Depression, but the pricing was bad, and then the prices just went through the ceiling when the World War began, because the soldiers needed meat. Soldiers and sailors needed meat, and herring would fill that bill, so...
Right.
Suddenly he was making a lot of money. What did he say? One night he made $150 selling herring.
Yeah, which I bet at the time was...
Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine?
Well, compared to 75 cents.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
So things were getting better. Things were getting better.
That's excellent. So, and I heard, maybe we'll hear more about this, he built the house that they were being interviewed in 1930?
Right. It's 1931. He built the house that the interviews were being held in, his permanent residence, prior to that in, I think he was saying, Chicago Bay. Did that sound accurate?
Yeah, I think so.
He had been living out of a log house he built.
Oh, okay.
And again, talk about that generation of people that just did everything. If anything was going to get done, they did it.
Right.
You know, he moved to Hovland, built his own home.
Yeah.
And then went out fishing every day and made 75 cents for 100 pounds of fish. And,
right.
Oh, man.
And you know...
Wow.
I can't imagine that he complained...
Probably not.
He just kind of, that's the way it is.
It's a living, right?
We'll just wait until tomorrow and see what happens then.
Maybe we'll get better prices and maybe the catch will be bigger. Unbelievable.
Well, we're overdue for a sponsor break, but don't go away. We've got plenty more Helmer Okvik coming up right after this.
GSPN is proud to announce the holiday recording session that is bound to become a holiday favorite for the whole family. Do You Hear What I Hear? The Cabin Country Holiday Album. Bud Klugman and Bjorn Lloydstad are joined by YouTube sensations Billy and Johnny as they offer up their favorites from the season of peace on earth and goodwill towards all. You'll hear such seasonal offerings as...
Simply building a deck with a screened-in porch.
The Ode to Turning on the Water at the Cabin During Winter Break.
I've dreamed the RV freeze and cranked up the heat.
Let it flow, let it flow, let it flow.
Signed the hunter in his stand to his pal.
Do you hear what I hear?
Buck who's in the leaves, distant pal.
Do you hear what I hear?
The rollicking holiday tune keeps them twisting near the eggnog, Aluminum Dock.
Aluminum, aluminum, aluminum dock. Aluminum steps and aluminum planks.
The favorite of old Blue Eyes fans everywhere.
Oh, by gosh, by golly, it's the last of my frozen walleye. Tasty pheasants and Christmas presents. And pheasants, 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 and pheasants.
Bud and Bjorn's seasonal ode to Gull River bass fishing.
We trolled our favorite bay.
Lake Weeds grew near the top. The brock got one a million times, and soon the mower stopped. Jingle bells, jingle all the way.
And the holiday classical favorite from Peter Tchaikovsky, Mallard Dance. The holidays only come once a year, but you can keep the embers glowing all year long. Do You Hear What I Hear? The Cabin Country Holiday Album. Available on all your favorite MP3 sources, as well as on CD and cassette and 8-track tape at all Fiber Stop stores in the Cabin Country area. And don't forget, they make great Christmas gifts for that outdoors person in your family.
Keep it down!
Well, let's continue on and see what more
Helmer has to tell us.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, now, did you smoke any fish here?
Yeah, for my own use. I never smoked commercially. Mm-hmm. No. You see, when the trout fishing went on the brink, and then the tourists, they quit coming, you see. Much right. Unmean for the commercial.
Right.
Yeah, so then I roomed around here for until 55, and I went to Alaska.
Hmm. Oh, really?
I didn't know that.
In fact, I was skippering a boat there, captain, what they call them, you see.
Mm-hmm. What kind of a boat there?
Oh, that was a big one. In the channel, there's in the Lynn Channel, sockeye salmon, because we was out in the ocean, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back here, and then it was all finished up. Herring went on the brick. Oh, here is a few herring. Last summer I got two herring. Can you beat that? I had
two.
We didn't get enough to eat because we usually eat three or not. But I didn't. That little, I heard the people get some ciscos. That was my specialty. And they are gone.
Cisco's are gone.
Nobody knows the cause of it, no.
How about the Menominee?
Yeah, they are here. Not much, though, but you can get enough to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows the cause. Some blame it on the taconite, and some blame it on the smelt.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know. I got another philosophy. Because 70 years ago, or 80 now, the blue fins, they were a fish about that, made about 3 pounds.
Yeah.
Oh, they were good. Oh. Yeah, there is no fish compared with them, to my taste. And they were plentiful. Mm. There was no smelt in the lake. There was no pollution. Mm. There was nothing. They disappeared. Yeah.
Well, that's a herring, isn't it?
No, it's a, no. They don't be fooled. They call this a herring bluefin. That ain't bluefin. No, that was a special fish. Yeah.
Different than a whitefish or a herring?
Yeah, they were a different species. So there's nothing to blame either pollution or smelt. And the herring, they went the same way now. Nobody knows.
Hmm.
I suppose they outlived their cycle or something.
Well, it's hard to know.
When I first started here, in Auburn, I came in 27, like I say. I had Cisco rigged there. There was a different species there. You call them long yoke. They were different than this here that came on now later on. Oh, they were brandyful here 10 years back.
What did they call it?
Long yoke Cisco's here.
Oh.
And this here that die out now, there was a different species. Different.
Hmm.
Me and my grandson, we done good here. We had to sort them, of course, in 200-pound barrels. And we got $27, $30 a barrel. So that was good for the time being.
So you were in Alaska in 55, you said. How long did you stay up there then?
For a season.
One season.
Yeah.
But you never sold this house, you?
Oh, no, no.
Well, then it wasn't too long after that when you came back here and got in that big storm.
Yeah, no, it wasn't too long, no.
You know, and we'll cut in here, Fudd, real quickly, just kind of touching base with some of the fish species Helmer was talking about that were a common catch for many, many years on Lake Superior and then just kind of dried up. You know, he was talking about catching herring.
Right.
You know, and those 200-pound barrels of herring and how they were fetching 75 cents at a throw or whatever. The war years where the prices went through the ceiling, but then the herring sort of vanished.
Kind
of
went pot, you know.
Yeah.
And he talked about bringing in the nets and having two herring. He couldn't get enough to eat, you know. I think I heard him talk about a species he liked very much that he said went about 3 pounds apiece called bluefin.
Oh, yeah.
And he said it was a specific species, not like the herring, different. And he said, you know, they tasted very, very good. It was a unique. He said there was nothing, in his estimation, if you picked up on this, that you know, he felt there was nothing better out of Lake Superior as far as taste.
It's delicious.
He loved those bluefins. And then they kind of ran their course, and he was blaming it on one of two things. He said either pollution from the taconite industry.
Taconite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Great Lakes iron ore production and some of that just ending up in the lake either through, you know, I guess spills at the taconite loading areas or perhaps even some of the Great Lakes shipping, you know, disasters, ships sure. going down and right. taconite ending up all over the floor of Lake Superior in the fishing areas. Then he also talked about the smelt yeah. coming in. And how smelt was sort of, I think, I get the feeling Helmer's suggesting that smelt are kind of an invasive species and have crowded out some of these others.
And didn't he say there was a period when there were no smelt?
No smelt at all, and he was having a great catch of the bluefins and the herring, and then the smelt show up, and suddenly he's just not catching either anymore to any situation. One piece I, in my wisdom accidentally edited out, sadly, Fudd, was he talked about the trout and how the tourists would come
oh, sure.
to fish trout, and they'd catch, you know, hundreds of pounds of trout, and then he said, and then the lampfish arrived, and the trout dried up.
And lampfish.
And lampfish. I believe by lampfish he was pertaining to the sea lamprey, which is an invasive species to the Great Lakes, and they will attach themselves to the size of specifically lake trout, the bigger fish.
Okay.
And just slowly draw sustenance off these fish and by default end up killing the host fish. And, you know, lamprey is considered good eating, if you will, in Europe.
Huh.
And European stocks are declining and they're fretting the disappearance of the lampreys in places like Spain and Portugal. But here in the United States, you know, on the Great Lakes, people aren't real happy to see the sea lamprey, and it's decimated some of the larger fish in Lake Superior. So away went Helmer's trout fishing as the lampfish came in and took them away. He was talking ciscos as well and how they seem to be not quite as easy to find. And then there was a breed or species of cisco he was talking about, Fudd, and I can't lie, I... My Helmer decoder ring is not coming up with that particular... He kept
what he
a
meant?
Long O, long nose, long yoke. I'm not sure what he was saying. Long something cisco.
They call them long yoke.
And it was a different species of cisco, and they were plentiful for a while. I got the feeling they'd passed away as well. They'd moved on, and were not as plentiful. Anyway, lots of Great Lake species and how the lake has changed, and... Is it taconite? Is it pollution? Is it invasive species, you know, brought in and ballast that's dumped out from these freighters that come from other parts of the world? It's hard to say.
Right.
It's hard to say.
And that was, was he specific on, like, when they kind of died out? Well,
I was having a hard time getting a grasp on when that was. I was thinking he was talking about, like, the late 40s, 50s, things began to kind of vanish. 50s through the early 60s, just not
sure.
catching these things as much anymore. He and his grandson going out.
Right.
Coming up with two herring
yeah.
in the nets, you know, no bluefin, and how things had changed, and there's smelt everywhere, but you can't find, You know, and I got the I'm picking up from Helmer's discussion here that smelt is not one of his favorite fish.
Right. kind of a fisherman's enemy.
A trash fish, if you will, a junk fish. Our fathers would have beaten them on the sides of the boats until they were dead and thrown them out for the gulls. But I know a lot of Minnesotans who love the smelt run.
Yeah.
Go up and net smelt, and the oil fires are going, and
wow,
bellying up, as it were. But
let me see if... hold on a second. I want to try to pull off some Dave Basanko reference here on the shelf
on
some of these fish species. I did find the sea lamprey. It's described as having an eel-like body, round, sucking disc mouth, 7 paired gill openings, dorsal fin extends to the tail. It's native to the Atlantic Ocean. The first specimen was found in Lake Superior in 1936, and then soon after, the lake trout and whitefish populations declined, but apparently control measures have reduced sea lamprey numbers, allowing native fish populations to slowly recover. So, yeah, as you said, it was a kind of a parasitic.
Right, invasive.
I also found the cisco.
Dave tells us what about the cisco foot? What does he say?
The largest whitefish in North America, and until the mid-1950s, a significant part of Minnesota's commercial fishery.
Well, there we go.
Along with walleye, lake whitefish are considered by many to be the finest food fish from Minnesota waters. Now, you
wow.
were just explaining to me how these
right.
whitefish yeah. fries happen. What is that?
Well, there's entail? Two things. I Captain Dave likes to go up to the Minnesota Commercial Fishing Museum and,
sure.
and spend time, and he was a construction guy for time up on kind of the Duluth Range area and going north alongside the lake, lakeshore communities. And he talked about all these different places that will sell smoked fish.
Right.
Kind of a Great Lakes tradition, you know, lakeside vendors smoking their own fish. And it's usually whitefish.
Uh-huh.
So smoked whitefish, very, very common, or ciscos, I guess you could say.
Okay.
I swear I've got a buddy who, the gent who loves to catch snapping turtles.
Oh,
and enjoy all 18 different kinds of meat off a snapping turtle, right? And I kid you not, Fudd, I know he refers to these fish as tulabies.
Huh.
Kind of, I dare say more of a Wisconsin term for the whitefish. I think it's the same thing. Someone will probably get back to us, and Don will field some ornery phone calls, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. Don, get him off the air. But yeah, a second piece that's very commonplace along the Great Lakes shore is something called a fish boil.
Uh-huh.
And usually centered around whitefish. And just a quick piece here off my handy dandy computer in my hand,
awesome.
My fabulous phone. A fish boil is a culinary tradition in areas of Wisconsin along the coastal upper Great Lakes, where you'll find large Scandinavian populations. Fish boils enjoy a particularly strong presence in Door County, Port Wing in Port Washington, Wisconsin. While it involves a huge cauldron full of fish, potatoes, corn, all these kinds of things. And then at some point during the cooking, I know that, I believe it's kerosene is added to the cooking fire under the cauldron. And it just, you know, explodes in flames and the pot just boils over. You know, all the
wow.
excess water is kind of blasted out of that cauldron, and the white fish, the rise in heat and everything, they're efficiently cooked and ready for the table. And people, almost like a crawfish boil down in New Orleans, the table's covered in newspaper and plates and salt and butter, and, you know, sit down and eat your fill of of ciscos / whitefish. In this case, fresh, and apparently quite tasty. I don't believe I've ever had it. How about yourself, Fudd? Are you...
No, I haven't.
Connoisseur of whitefish.
I'm wondering if anything is yelled when the pots are set ablaze, because it reminds me a little bit of the traditional cheese dish in Greek culinary tradition. You set the plate on fire and you yell like, "Opa!"
Indeed.
So I wonder if there's something like, "Cisco!" Wait a minute, that's an old show. Oh, Cisco Kid! Yes.
Ah, yes, suddenly the Cisco Kid makes his
right.
appearance. Perhaps a westward-looking cowpoke comes walking out, joins you at the table, tucks in his neckerchief around his shirt and bellies up to some whitefish boil. I'm told it's quite an event, and it's a community event where people come together and do this kind of thing. But I always wondered, kerosene, wouldn't that add kind of a curious aroma to the vicinity?
Yeah, well, must just burn away.
I think it burns off quickly, and the like I said, the water in that cauldron kind of boils over like a geyser, and then it's time to eat.
You know what, Bjorn, this sounds like it would be a good Cabin Country podcast episode.
It would be.
You know, look up a place to head in Door County, Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
And see if we can sit in on one
Port
of these.
Port Wing. Have some smoked fish, and then as you're belching a little smoked whitefish or Cisco or Wisco, if you'd rather.
Wisco.
Sit down at a fish boil and tuck in a bit of tablecloth into our shirts and get ready to go.
Right.
See what it's all about. It's supposed to be good.
Well,
whitefish is supposed to be very tasty. They're still catching them.
I don't doubt it. I would like to try it. Being a fish,
still catching
them.
No, you're an aficionado, Fudd.
Aficionado, yeah.
No questions asked.
Would love to try it.
A lousy pun in there as well.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll hear Helmer Ockvik's incredible rescue attempt of his neighbor in the icy November waters of Lake Superior. Right after this.
Mitt's Coffee, the purveyors of fine drinks that brought you Laughing Goose Dark Roast and other fine coffees, are now proud to announce the arrival of
Thundermug Morning Jolt. Thundermug is a medium roast coffee blend that will not shock your taste buds or leave you with that all too familiar strong coffee breath. But at three times the normal caffeine levels, Thundermug will flush away all the morning cobwebs and make your brain swirl to life. A perfect morning blast to jet you into your day. If you don't have the time for the multiple refills that many coffee lovers require, a single cup of Thundermug will prime you for a day that might not allow for trips to the coffee maker or anywhere else for that matter. No nonsense, no refills necessary. Thundermug.
Thundermug is proudly offered by Mitt's Coffee, the brew that flew with the great Northwest.
It's time now for another literary moment, when we read a small portion of great classic literature, embellished with just a touch of Cabin Country. Listen now as Bjorn reads from Ernest Hemingway's popular short story, The Old Man and the Bucket Mouth.
"I'll just steer south and west," he said. "A man is never lost on the chain, and it is a long, narrow lake." It was on the third turn across the south of Daggett Lake that he first saw the fish. He saw him first as a dark shadow that took so long to pass under the boat that he could not believe its length. "No," he said, "a bucket mouth can't be that big." But he was that big, and at the end of this circle he came to the surface only 3 yards away. The man saw his tail out of the water. It was higher than a big hunting blade and a drab military green above the clear blue water. It raked back, and as the fish swam just below the surface, the old man could see his huge bulk and the black mottling that marked him. His dorsal fin was down, and his huge pectorals were spread wide. On this circle, the old man could see the fish's eye and the two gray panfish that swam hurriedly away from him. From the weeds along the shore, a tall blue heron began to take notice. The old man was sweating now, but from something else besides the sun. On each calm, placid turn the fish made, he was gaining line, and he was sure that in just two more turns he would have a chance to get the jitterbug set. "But I must get him close, close, close," he thought. "I mustn't try for the gills. I must get him right in the mouth." "Be calm and strong, old man," he said. On the next circle, the fish's back was out, but he was a little too far from the boat. On the next circle, he was still too far away, but he was higher out of the water, and the old man was sure that by gaining some more line, he could have him alongside. He had rigged his white plastic lure long before, and its coil of light gauge test was in the reel 3 of knots. The fish was coming in on his circle, now calm and beautiful looking, and only his great tail moving. The old man pulled on him all that he could to bring him closer. For just a moment, the fish turned a little on his side. Then as he straightened himself and began another circle. "I moved him," the old man said. "I moved him then." He felt faint again now, but he held on the great fish all the strain that he could. "I moved him," he thought. "Maybe this time I can get him over and into the landing net." "Pull, hands," he thought. "Hold up, legs. Last for me, head. Last for me." You never went, but this time I'll pull him over. I'll win the Whitefish Chain Largemouth Contest this year, no doubt.
Next time on the Cabin Country Literary Moment, Bjorn reads from Edgar Allan Poe's hair-raising, The Fall of the Hunting Shack of Usher.
And now back to Bjorn Lloydstad and Fudd Klugman in Cabin Country. Now, to kind of get us back to where Helmer's going with this, there's a couple bits here. 1958.
A significant year.
Was a very significant year for Helmer. He went out after a neighbor who was warned about, as Mr. Lightfoot would say, when the gales of November come slashing. there it is. And the big water and the cold water. An interesting sidelight. I was talking to some of the people at the Minnesota Commercial Fishing Museum. And a common trait among some of these old fishermen was that none of them could swim.
Huh.
They were non-swimmers. And the way I heard it told to me from some of the good staff at the Commercial Fishing Museum was, what was the point? The water's cold, you're in your oilskins, you're out there by yourself, it's, you know, early morning or late in the afternoon, the water is often gone from pleasant to crazy, you know, active, big swells. The blue skies have turned into, you know, thunderheads rolling in, and it's cold. And you go over the side, you're going to sink like a rock.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're in your oilskins and your rubber boots, and all the woolens you're wearing are now heavy with water, and even if you could swim, good luck, you know? So a lot of these folks couldn't swim and just kind of trusted to Providence and the good Lord that they'd make their way back to shore, and that's just how it was. So in an interesting piece, but getting back to the 1958 event, what do you know about it, Fudd? What can you tell me here?
As you mentioned, he set out to go find this neighbor of his that foolishly went out in weather that was quickly growing pretty
foul,
bad,
not good.
And he went out and risked his own life to go and find this other. And
he was in his 60s.
Okay.
As I read it and hear it and think about it and talk with people who've heard the story, he was in his 60s, and he knew this younger guy, now in his 40s, I think, 30s or 40s, had gone out to check his nets and was warned repeatedly not to do it. The weather's bad. Don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And who would believe it? A kind of a hard-headed old Norwegian himself. Yeah, whatever. I'm going out to check my nets. There's fish out there. He went and didn't come back in. And Helmer said, all right, well, I'm going after him.
Mm-hmm.
And as he said, I'm a man of my word. I'm coming back.
Yeah.
And it turned into what it sounds like quite an evening. He said the doctor was down on the dock with a stretcher as the Coast Guard brought him back.
Sure.
Yeah. And 100 people kind of hooting and hollering, oh my goodness, down on the dock. And he's saying, oh, what's the big deal? I told you I was coming back. You shouldn't be surprised by all this. Quite a thing. I think he's talking about, you know, 10, 15-foot swells.
Yeah.
Getting pulled out on the lake. Wow. He'll do a better job. It may take a while, but he'll tell us about this. And it's something else. I mean, what he, in that classic kind of, aw shucks, it was nothing, Norwegian fisherman kind of approach, just describes as another day into night out on Lake Superior. My gosh, that would be a life-defining moment for the bulk of us.
Christine, what was it?
What?
When I came up from the lake, 58, there was over 100 people, I guess, on the dock. People went crazy for nothing.
Yeah.
He had a stretcher. Dr. Smith, he's still living. He had a stretcher he was coming to. And I walked by my own power up from the school, from the lunch study.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to say to this fisherman that I'll always come back, remember that?
Yeah.
Well, he says, you are a man of your word, you're back.
How long did you stay out there?
Well, I went out to 8 in the morning, didn't I? And I spent the night out in the lake and didn't come to the doctor before noon, Doc in Holland.
Well, now, it was a young man, Carl Hammer.
Yeah.
How old was he, in his 20s? Or?
How old was Carl?
I don't know.
27? Something like that. No, he wasn't that old.
He wasn't
old. He must have been when he was in the Navy in World War II.
He came out from the Navy, you see, a year before. Mm-hmm.
Well, he had his own business.
Yeah.
He didn't work for you.
Oh, no, he didn't. No. See, two times before he went out where he shouldn't go out. And I says, young man, you don't practice the technique. Mm-hmm. You see, he'd been on a destroyer in the Navy. I says, remember, Carl, life on a destroyer is from 70 to 100 men. That's different when you get in a skiff out here, see, and endangered. Mm-hmm. You mustn't forget that. And you blew it out.
So you saw him that morning before he went out?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
No. We had an old man staying here, and he seemed to know that he went out.
He stayed. How did he seem to know? He walked, he walked over here to look at his car, and then he seen Carl's car standing here, so then he knew he was going out.
Oh, I see.
Because it was such a storm, nobody would plan to go out.
Yeah.
No. Well, there wasn't much storm when he went out. Yeah. He shouldn't have gone out. And he was so careless, too, see. You see, I had the old-fashioned outboards, old-time Janssens. And he had this more modern ones that you should strain gas, you see.
Strain gas?
Yeah, you should strain the gas on them, you know. He had a new Janssen motor. You see, I had to have 2 quarts of oil in my 5 gallon of gas. Mm-hmm. And he said, the modern ones, you see, you shouldn't have more than 1 quart. Mm-hmm. So he took gas from my can right and left. Not that I can, you see, but... So that's why his motor stalled, you see.
Oh.
Yeah, I almost got him. But he must have been excited, you see, because so panicky when I started to blow down serious. He was just going to set 2 nuts, mm-hmm. dry nuts. If he had let them out, you see, he couldn't have drifted very far. He would have been in eyesight till afternoon anyway. You see, when to drag them long nuts, you know, when they get deep in the hole, he couldn't move very fast. Instead of that, he went like a chip, you know, with a skiff, you know, light. Mm-hmm. And he had no hammer, nothing. He had a pair of rubber gloves, you know, the coldest thing you can have, you know, that's a big question.
Well, they're cold?
Cold. Hmm. I tell you, they're cold. When you were out in...
It was November, and it was... 14 degrees above
Thanksgiving.
Zero. Yeah.
There were six about. If we had a hammer, you see, to chop ice. I still, but of course, there was no hope for him, you see. There's something you don't understand. I tried to save him. But you see, when it gets that cold, towards that time of year in Thanksgiving, the lake smokes. Now, you've seen that probably.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, 30, 40 feet high. It's just like fog. You can't see nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think we have to kind of interpret a little bit of Helmer's description
Rogue,
of what was going on.
The layman try to explain some of the Akvik dialect.
Yes, we're talking about the motors. They both have Janssens.
Yes.
Janssen motors.
As I understood Helmer here, Fudd, it sounds like his... gas tanks, he had to put in 2 quarts of oil for a full gas tank, and that Carl had a newer type of motor that only required 1. And then he said he'd borrowed his, maybe I misread it here, heard him wrong, but he had borrowed perhaps Carl's, or Carl had borrowed Helmer's gas tank and gone out.
Oh, and only
and as a result... the motors weren't running properly on Helmer's gasoline, and as a result, his lines probably froze up and stopped working. The motors just wouldn't run with the 2 quarts of oil, and
that was a significant problem.
Right, and then he also mentioned, if you didn't catch this, that Carl went out with no hammer for knocking ice off the boat, and was going to set 2 lines, and I believe Helmer was saying at that point he would have been floating, kind of trapped in ice.
Oh yeah.
That with no motors he would have been stuck in the ice in his little skiff, and
So problems with that, and with no hammer, all he had was rubber gloves.
Which are cold.
Cold. I tell you, they're cold.
Right.
Apparently. So that was not the proper set of tools with which to chop ice.
Right.
And he's just now going into saying he was trying to plot what Carl's course probably would have been drifting.
Right.
Where he had planned to set nets. He seemed to know what Carl's usual plan was for net setting, and he figured that's where this guy will be, and I'm going to go out and try to find him. Because if his engines died, which they must have done, and he has no capacity for knocking ice off the skiff, he's going to be drifting. I think he said like a chip, like a chip.
Oh.
Like a chip of wood or something. You know, he's just floating out there in the pack ice, kind of drifting away.
Also, he mentioned that it was 6 degrees above zero.
Right.
And extremely foggy. It creates smoke, as
he
says.
The lake smokes.
30 to 40 feet high.
You can't see anything.
Can't see anything. So this younger man is out with the ice is freezing in the bottom of his boat, nothing to break it up. His motors are frozen. The gas doesn't have the proper amount of oil in it. And he's just drifting like a chip.
Yes.
On the waves. And then Helmer takes off in his even keeled way to go after him.
Where he thinks he would probably find him. And I, FUD, for one, love having the back and forth between Helmer and his wife, Christine.
Yes.
It's pretty priceless. He couldn't have been that young. He served in the Second World War. And I won't lie to you, FUD, there's a few things Helmer will say from time to time where I would love a decoder ring or something, because I have no idea what he just said. But
yeah, we can't quite do a visual caption for this being an audio podcast here. But we can cut in like we do here and try to interpret at least how we've heard it.
Correct.
Helmern's, Janssen's, and a hammer, and rubber gloves, and the smoke 30 to 40 feet high on the water. Well,
should we return to
let's continue.
The tale of Helmer.
With the adventure as he sets out.
So I went right after where I thought he'd be. Coming 5, 6, 7 miles out, I suppose. I figured he must have drifted that far at least. Then I got trouble with my motors. I froze up.
Hmm.
No, there was no picnic.
Then why did they freeze up on you?
The gasoline.
Gas?
Yeah. My one thing I wasn't prepared for, this was the can of heat, you see.
Yeah.
That would have been all right. Then I was stuck. I drifted myself like a ship, you know. Way out. When I got out there, probably 12, 14 miles. And the sea got so big, you see. Oh, I got one breaker over me, you see. And the skiff was quarter full of water. Start bailing before it froze, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So I drifted, and I drifted. There was a jet that flew over me. It flew right over me. They were sent out from Finland, you see. They were searching for us.
Oh, yeah.
I must have been 50 miles out in the lake.
50 miles?
50 miles.
Wow.
And the skiff, you know, from all that pounding, it started leaking bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Flat bottom. So I piked on for the night and drifted and drifted. And in the morning, I never forget that. Everything was froze. My mittens were froze. Funny, my hands were worn.
Huh.
Really?
Because I'd pulled the mittens inside. Yeah, sure.
Hmm. Think they are numb?
You don't know what wool, huh?
You think they are just numb?
No, it's all right on the fingers, by the step. And see, the starter rope, you know, there ain't the pull start on that. You have to lay the rope, you know, in the groove of them old-timers, you see.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that was froze. It was bigger than my finger here, you see. So I had to, when the sun came up, I was waiting for it, I took one strand off, see. So it's easy to unravel one strand. And then I got it started. That old time I did, it started.
Started in the morning?
Yeah. So I run and I run until she got out of gas.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I'd seen, there's a fisherman east of here. Yeah, Hattie, that's up. Still fishing, Hattie. The wind is moderate going down as I change it to west, southwest. Mm-hmm. I said, thinking, but what should I do? Take a head rubber, yak it on. Take it off and cut the and cut the back off and then wrap it on the hand so I could grab the horse. Mm-hmm. That would have been a good idea. First I thought I ain't going to row under the heavy clunk. I had many old... I got 17 of them old-timers down there. Yeah.
17?
Motors, upwards, and then old-timers.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah. So, there's no sense of rowing on that thing. So I took and tossed overboard. I seen the bubbles after. That won't save my life, so I... So, I was just going to take the rubber jacket up. No, it was oilskin. And here came the Coast Guard lunch. How can you beat that, yeah? I wanted to go back, you see, and look for him. Of course, I was new, you stand, but the Coast Guard skipper there, he says, no. I'm still kind of big sea. And I lost the skiff. See, them kids, they knew no seamanship. They tried to lasso the skiff, you see, to tow it. They tore the gunwale off. Mm-hmm. Lost it.
Yes,
so I said, I said, forget it.
So it sank right out there then?
Yeah. I landed in Two Harbor Hospital.
That's
not
what
that I needed it exactly, but I had two frozen toes. You know why?
No.
Because when I got out in that big sea, you see, in the ice and spray, I froze immediately. You couldn't. Oh, I tell you, it was an ordeal. So I had to crawl on my knees in there to chop the ice. Else you would have built up ice in no time and you would have capsized, I knew that. I had hip boots. Don't you think that they split right over the knee?
Oh, is that?
When I crawled, you know, and lucky I discovered it in time. There was water in the skiff then, you see. Mm-hmm. I discovered it just in time, see, to save my foot. You see, if I gotten wet, would have froze in the night. Absolutely. Would have lost the foot, maybe.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, what was going through your mind out there?
Oh, not really. I've been in danger so many times. There was a nice scenery there at night. The moon was so beautiful. Yeah.
You knew you would make it.
Yeah. I made it just in time. Because that night, evening, about Thanksgiving evening, I tell you, it started cold. It was below zero then, and freeze off and swing the last of 2 weeks. Oh, that was frightful. So if I hadn't come in that far, I probably wouldn't have made it.
How far out were you when the
I can't really tell, you see. On the gasoline, I must have been 50 miles up. 40 in a way.
Okay, but when they picked you up, how far out were you?
No. That was a couple of miles from shore.
Were you drifting towards the shore as you were going?
No, I wasn't drifting out to shore. I had to... The wind was south-southwest, like I say, and the wind came kind of askew, but I would have had easy rowing, you see, to Reservation Bay or to Pody, Grand Pody.
See, the southwest is coming across from that way.
No.
And then he'd have to just angle the boat in slightly. He'd have missed Hovland, but he would have gone up about 5 miles or 10 miles up.
I was in the hospital for 2 days. And shortly after, the fellow from Reader said, yes, came. He wanted a story. I says, this is nothing, it's just routine that we do to help each other, you see. And afterwards, about 3 years afterwards, then it came, you know, in the Reader's yes.
That's that story that...
Yeah, exaggerated much, you know.
Yeah.
You know that, yeah. Yeah, I'm an honest man, but I tell you, I was tough enough for it. Up there that night. It was no joke.
No.
I got a medal.
Huh?
And $500 price, you know. Yeah.
Really?
Is that right?
Yeah. I got a letter. I don't know where it came from. It came from addressed the old man of the sea. Uh-huh. It came here, believe it or not. Yeah.
Yes,
I still got it.
Yes.
Oh, I got a beer case full of letters, you know, from well-wishers, you see.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Some were religious and wanted to know what I thought about God out there, and mm-hmm. well meant, you know, yeah. And money, got money, and that was mm-hmm. from $2 to $10.
What were your religious feelings? Did you have any out there?
No, you didn't have much time for that. No, I'm telling the truth. Self-preservation, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so he had motor trouble himself. He drifted out 40, 50 miles.
Correct.
Or did he say that he went out about 14 miles and that's when he had motor trouble?
That's how I understood it. He got about 14 miles out and then his motor started causing him grief. And the gas freezing up. And he talked at one point about if he'd have had a can of heat.
Yeah.
That would have helped. And I remember my dad was a big proponent of heat when the car got...
Oh, yeah, right.
So sitting outside and you've plugged in the head bolt heater, but you keep the gas tank full and you put in a bottle of heat. It's isopropyl alcohol. You know, help keep the gas liquid instead of freezing up. And he didn't have that. So things were getting rough. And it sounded like he was saying one of his motors was the type where you had to put a rope on the top of the engine, pull the rope to get it to fire. And the rope or the line was all kind of frozen and fouled, so his gloves were frozen, but his hands were still warm because he had woolen mittens inside his gloves.
Right, right.
And so he was able to take one of the strands apart from the kind of pull cord of the engine, and the sun had come up now. And so he managed to get the one motor running. The other one was still dead. He had so many that he didn't feel too bad about filling with water and bailing, riding low, and it's just extra weight on the back, and it won't start anyway, so I'm just going to...
Toss it over.
Let it go. Yeah, watch the bubbles as the motor heads to the deep.
And, well, I had 17 motors, you know.
Yes, yes.
Got rid of that extra weight. And he drifted, 40, 50 miles out, and enjoyed the full moon.
Right.
And
didn't have time to think about religion because
right.
self-preservation had kicked in.
There's no time to think about that. But then when he was found, he was just a couple of miles offshore.
Right, right.
And it sounds kind of comical because so there was a rescue boat or something.
Right.
And they got Helmer aboard. And then what happened? They tried to...
Yeah, he talked about the young guys on the Coast Guard cutter and how they didn't have much seamanship, and they tried lassoing his skiff and ripped the gunwale off the skiff.
then
lost the boat. So he kept it afloat all night long.
Thanks for nothing.
And he's fairly disgusted with the fact that these young bucks had managed to get him on board but lose his skiff, which he kept afloat all night long amidst... heavy seas and ice.
Brought him to a hospital in Two Harbors, which he didn't think was necessary, but he spent two nights there. And
well, I would assume they saved his toes, you know.
Probably. Yeah. Well, and afterwards he said he did receive letters and money. He did say $500.
A medal and $500, and then a briefcase full of letters from people saying, oh, my goodness, amazing, and offering their religious insight into his being saved and all these things. And he even sent him money, you know, upwards of $2 to $10.
$10, oh. Well, maybe he could replace that boat or the motor he had to heft over.
The one part I really thought was interesting, Fudd, was where he talked about the Coast Guard getting there and getting him on board their vessel. I'm kind of filling in some blanks here. He never actually said as much that they got him on board the Coast Guard cutter, but he talked about wanting to go back out with the Coast Guard and trying to find Carl.
Oh.
And they kept saying, no, the seas are too high. There's no way we'll find him. You couldn't find him. They had a jet fly over. Came over looking for finding him and whereabouts he was and getting out to him. And Apparently the Yet couldn't see Carl anywhere. My guess is, sadly, Carl must have ended up in Davy Jones' locker.
I think so. And I think so. I like how Helmer referred to Lake Superior as the sea.
Yes. The seas were big, and the sea was coming in, and it was freezing solid, and he had climbed forward in his rubber waders and bail out that water and that ice and chip off the ice, and then it split right above the knee, and if that wouldn't have happened, he wouldn't have had frozen toes.
Right.
Thinking about perhaps taking off his oilskin and wrapping it around his hands so he could row. I'm thinking, how do you row in a semi-frozen bay? You know, how would that happen? And I think he might have realized, yeah, that's not happening. And interesting, too, how the winds had changed on him, and they were coming out of the south-southwest.
Yeah.
And the interviewer was trying to explain to another interviewer where that might have landed him. You know, he would have missed Hovland, but he would have ended up 5 or 6 miles farther north, and possibly even Grand Marais. And, wow. You know, I'm trying to put ashore. Just crazy kind of stuff that it boggles my mind, you know.
And how he remained calm. He knew he was going to make it.
Yep. He said he was a man of his word. He was coming back. And he came back. For me, it just comes back to a lake the size of Superior.
Right.
You know.
To be 40, 50 miles out, I mean, oh my goodness. And
50 miles out in 30 feet high smoke.
Right.
The fog is 30 feet, 40 feet high. I can't see anything. I'm in the ice. It's pitch black.
6 degrees above zero.
Oh, man, 6 degrees above. Last thing I'd want to do.
And then he said it was a good thing he came back when he did, because the next day was below zero.
Right.
And it's hard enough going out to your driveway when it's blowing and just in the teens and you're wrapped up and can go in for a coffee break anytime. But
right.
To be out on the water, man, that's let me tell you, that's cool.
Let me tell you.
Wow.
Unbelievable. So if you hung with us, I applaud you. And
yes.
You know, a good many who've heard Helmer's tale, courtesy our friends at the Minnesota Commercial Fishing Museum, thanks to them again for supplying this information and allowing us to air Helmer's tale. It's pretty amazing
pretty cool.
stuff. Pretty amazing stuff. Cut from a tougher cloth, without a doubt.
Well, perhaps it's time to cast off for the evening.
Draw close here to some heavy Scandinavian brogue for the evening.
Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time in Cabin Country.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.